$100, $200 a month for a year or more, whatever is in your budget, we cut it off at whatever time you say. It does not have to be a year. And you would be doing, again, something great for yourself and your community this morning. 800-222-9739. Or you can go online to WPFWFM.org as we move to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. This is WPFW Washington.
Ethelbert Miller.
Recording.
Miller. My guest today is Tess Chakalagil. Tess Chakalagil teaches African-American and American literature at Bowdoin College. She's the author of novel Bondage, Slavery, and Marriage and Freedom in 19th Century America. Her new book is A Matter of Complexion, The Life and Fiction of Charles W. Chestnut, and that will be the book that we'll be discussing this morning during our pledge drive. And if you're listening to us today, make sure you think about making a pledge. Call 1-800-222-9739. That number is 1-800-222-9739. Tess, it's great to see you again, and I want to congratulate you on a fascinating book that I hope that our listeners will enjoy you talking about. But I want to begin by asking a very basic question. Actually, two questions together. Why write a biography? I mean, you've written other books. Why write a biography? And what did you want people to know about Charles Chestnut?
Well, a biography is introducing the author to a general audience. I've been writing about and reading Chestnut and teaching Chestnut for decades, really. And it always surprised me that with every new batch of students I got, I would have to reintroduce Chestnut to these students who had never heard of him. And in fact, most people still haven't heard of Charles W. Chestnut. So I wanted this to be an introductory kind of story to the life, the fiction, and of course, the historical times in which Charles Chestnut lived to a general audience. And so this is really a kind of, at once, an homage to him, but also a way of enticing readers, new readers, to discover Charles Chestnut.
Yeah, I'm glad you say new readers, because, you know, I worked at Howard University for over 40 years, and those Chestnut's book was like on the shelf. You know, they didn't really move, you know, and so for you to have this biography, I felt I was learning a lot, you know, because I was passing those Chestnut's books, you know, and going to Langston Hughes, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, when you look at what you wanted to do, and this gets into, you know, Chestnut, when were you introduced to his work?
I was actually introduced to his work in graduate school when I took an introduction to African American literature class, and I read his novel, which is many considered to be the great American novel, or some would. I mean, a lot of people think of it as Moby Dick or, right, you know, whatever, or The Scarlet Letter. But The Mare of Tradition, published in 1901, is a recounting, a fictionalized recounting historical fiction of the racial massacre that occurred in Wilmington, North Carolina, in 1898. And so he was very familiar with this area, familiar with the issues, and it was that novel that I read which gave me my introduction to Charles Chestnut, and it was a novel that totally blew my mind. And from there, I just read everything I could get my hands on. I moved to Chapel Hill to complete my dissertation, actually to start my dissertation. It was there that I drove to all the different sites, to the Charles W. Chestnut Library at Fayetteville State. And I just became increasingly interested in learning more about him, and realized that what I needed to do was go to the archives, because there wasn't a lot being available, accessible. He wasn't one of the accessible writers. I mean, he had these great published novels, but it was hard to sort of learn about who he was and his methods. That's been changing since the early 90s. More and more scholars are publishing articles and monographs on him. And there's, of course, a Charles Chestnut Society. So there are people to talk to. But again, it's including the general audience, sort of taking him out of the academy and into the general public.
Well, you said something that was very interesting, Tess. And that is, you know, you got into this work in graduate school, you know, and this gets into the thing about, you know, undergraduate, you know, when I was at Howard, you know, it wasn't a writer that was, you know, on the syllabus. You know, if you say, okay, here's Zora Neale Hurston, here's, you know, these other writers, but Chestnut was not there.
So are you kind of asking why?
Yeah, exactly. why not on the undergraduate level where you are talking about pulling people in?
I mean, we went to probably did our undergraduates at very different times, but probably the curriculum was established in the same way. There were American writers, African-American writers, British writers, post-colonial writers. You know, that's how the English department, if you did your degree in English, that's how it was all divided up. And as I say in the biography, Chestnut really resisted these categories, identitarian categories, in which people, and for his purpose, literature has been divided up. And for that reason, because he doesn't fit neatly within one of those categories, he just wanted to be seen as, to be read as, a great literary artist. And so I think because of the ways in which English departments have become so committed to these identity categories, I think that's one of the reasons why Chestnut doesn't fit or wasn't read, or you don't find him on undergraduate syllabi.
Let's talk about the commitment you make, because, I mean, how many years did it take you to write this book?
About 10 years.
That's right. Thanks for that. You know, and you know, I would wonder in terms of looking at those 10 years, what type of academic, you know, financial support did you receive from your institutions?
I received a great deal of support from my home institution, Bowdoin College, where I teach and work, to travel to the archive. So I was able to apply for funding. I did apply for other grants, the Guggenheim Award, the National Endowment for the Humanities. None of those came through. All of those denied me, rejected me. But, you know, these are very competitive grants. I also applied to, you might have heard of the, I think it's called BIO, it's based in New York City. It's this kind of institute for writers of biography. They also rejected my application to work at their institute in New York City. And, you know, this is all fine, but Chestnut also experienced this kind of rejection.
Right.
Lifetime. As he put it, living so far away from the centers, from the literary centers, either, I don't know, on the West Coast, you have L.A. On the East Coast, it's Boston and New York City. I live in Brunswick, Maine, or I was working in Chapel Hill or Bowling Green or Laredo, Texas. These were different places where I've had teaching gigs. You know, that is the life of an academic now.
Yeah, but I also look at the life of the academic now, where someone would say in terms, okay, but this removal of DEI and things like that. So we don't want to fund a subject which is dealing with African-American culture. Okay.
No, I mean, when I was writing, I mean, there was a heavy investment in DEI.
Right.
You know, the dismantling of DEI is very recent. It's really the case against Harvard, and now with President Trump in office, that they're dismantling diversity.
That's why I was wondering whether it would be more difficult for, you know, we're talking about Chestnut, but there could be other authors that perhaps, you know, a person would want to do research on, but they can't get the money and this took you 10 years.
I actually felt, you know, this might sound a little counterintuitive to you, but I actually think that because Chestnut was really arguing against what we now call DEI, what he would call, you know, racial categories, segregation. I mean, Chestnut wanted to dismantle that. You see the epigraph of the book,
right?
A line from Chestnut that he gave in a speech: distinctions of color are overemphasized in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what DEI is. It's a commitment to color that Chestnut was against.
Mm-hmm.
And when I made those proposals and applications to those private and public foundations, I was very clear about that.
Right. Okay, let's talk about, you know, the 10 years and break that down. Talk about Fisk University, because you're now dealing with special collections, you're dealing with people who have left work, and also talk about Helen, his daughter, who wrote a biography in 1952. How does that biography, you know, differ from yours?
Sure. That's a great question, because Helen, of course, writes the first biography of her father, and they were very close. Helen became a teacher of Latin at the Cleveland Public High School. In fact, she was one of Langston Hughes's teachers, which she liked to tell people. And she kind of made an arrangement with Arna Bontemp, who, as you know, was the head librarian.
And a good friend of Langston.
And a good friend of Langston, a major figure in the Harlem Renaissance. And they actually, you know, he persuaded her to donate his papers, Chestnut's papers, to Fisk. And then he would help her publish her biography. As I say at the end of the book, it was, the professor at Howard, who you know, who wanted to do an earlier biography of Chestnut, Benjamin Brawley.
Mm-hmm.
And Helen decided she wanted to do one herself that really highlighted his role as a father, as a husband, a little bit more of the personal side of Chestnut, not just about his literary career, his work career. So, and it was a very loving biography that was published in 1952, but she didn't write a lot about the literature itself, though she gave a lot of the background of what was happening at home while he was writing. She didn't really go into any kind of analysis of the work. And that's what I tried to do in my biography.
Right. And talk about, you know, the material that was given to Fisk University.
Not everything, because some went to the Western Reserve Historical Society in Cleveland as well, especially a lot of his letters having to do with his career as a lawyer and a court reporter. So what you see at Fisk are the manuscripts. The unpublished manuscripts are there, galley copies, his journals, his personal journals from the time that he was a teacher at the Howard School in Fayetteville. Most of his correspondence is there, especially his important correspondence with Walter Hines Page and other editors at Houghton Mifflin that he worked with, some of his professional papers. So this is a really important collection that was given to Fisk and which they have preserved over the years and which was very important to me in order to complete this biography.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the biography, let's hear a little excerpt. And this is where, you know, we find Chestnut at the height of his career, actually.
Yeah, this is in the chapter entitled Literary Celebrity. Exalted by the critical success of the Colonel's Dream, but not yet aware of its disappointing sales, Chestnut was delighted when his invitation to Mark Twain's 70th birthday party arrived in the mail. The party was to be held at Delmonico's, the most fashionable restaurant in New York City, located on the corner of 26th Street and 5th Avenue, on Tuesday, December 5th at 8 o'clock. It was hosted by Colonel George Harvey, a successful businessman, editor of the North American Review, and president of the publishing firm Harper and Brothers. The party became known as the literary event of the new century. Harvey invited 170 guests, mostly well-known writers and humorists, had a 40-piece orchestra perform, provided everyone with elaborate party favors, including a foot-tall plaster of Paris bust of Twain, and printed a special menu with sketches by the popular cartoonist Leon Barrett, showing various episodes of Twain's spectacular rise to literary fame and fortune. The party was a grand celebration of Twain's life and work, but it was also meant to be a celebration of American literature and its writers. The New York Times described the event on its front page the following day. Quote, "Never before in the annals of this country had such a representative gathering of literary men and women been seen under one roof. They were representative in every conceivable respect, even geographically. There was no corner of this country that did not have at least one favorite son or daughter present. The far north and the extreme south, the New England states and the Pacific slope, all sent delegates. This was a gathering not just to celebrate Mark Twain. It was a symbol of the spirit of American democracy, manifested by its most beloved literary men and women. Chestnut fit right in.
You're listening to Tess Chicalico reading from her biography, A Matter of Complexion, The Life and Fiction of Charles W. Chestnut. Thank you for that reading, Tess. We're going to take a little break now. And I don't know if Katia is around to join us. Okay, she can join us by phone.
Good morning.
The number Ethel here. Burke. Okay, do you want to go on, Katia?
No, absolutely. No, please give the number and I'll just chime in with you.
Oh, the number is 1-800-222-9739, 1-800-222-9739, or 202-588-9739. Katia?
And just quickly, I'll say that, you know, this has been already a wonderful interview, and we thank you, Ethelbert, for all the good work. And this is the level of radio that Ethelbert brings you, the level of discourse, the quality of the guests that he brings you. I'm already learning so much. I was, as I'm waiting to pitch, I was Googling about him and his life's work, and he is a fascinating individual. So if you are like me and totally enthralled every week with On the Margin and the work that Ethelbert does, then we invite you now to pledge at the number that Ethelbert mentioned, which is 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. Our goal for this hour is $500. And Ethelbert, I'm confident we will make this. We've always done it. And the people respond to the great work that you do. So again, that number to make a pledge of support, 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. $500 to go. Ethelbert?
Okay, thank you. We're back here with Tess Chicalico. Tess, when I was reading your biography of Chestnut, I thought it was like a detective novel, you know, because there were things where you were speculating and stuff like that and discovering things. Am I reading too much into the
book? No, it was exactly like that. It actually felt like that when I was writing, because that is, as you know, as a rare book librarian, you find stuff in the archive that you didn't know existed. And that kept happening. It happened with his journals, where I discovered that section of his reading of Homer's Iliad that had not been published with the journals when it came out in 1993, because it had been edited out. It happened when I found his European journal, which had never been published, and that was at the Western Reserve Historical Society. And that brought a whole new light on his journeys to Europe. I mean, Chestnut traveled all over the place, which was so surprising for somebody, a Black man, particularly in the 1890s, to be traveling abroad as he did. And he kept a journal of what he read and what he was thinking and what he was buying.
Okay, let's go back and fill people in. Like Katia was Googling. Okay, so why don't you, Tess, talk about the world that Chestnut was born into? He was born in Cleveland in 1858, but grew up in North Carolina. Talk about what's going on at this time that he comes in, you know, he's being born, and in his early years, especially as a teacher.
Yeah, this is 1858. Uncle Tom's Cabin has been published. The abolition movement is in full swing. His parents are members of what was known at the time as the Free Colored Community of North Carolina, which he would go on in his adult life to write a mini history of, because a lot of people are not aware of this group. As Chestnut put it, as far as he knew, in his what he called ragged family tree, both sides, his mother's side and his father's side, were as free as far as they were able to record. So his up to his great grandparents were free on both sides, though he was of mixed race. His grandfather was a white man, as I explain. His grandmother was a Black woman. He writes about this too in his novel, The House Behind the Cedars, how these relationships formed. And the consequences, by which I mean their children, that were produced out of these free, consensual, interracial relationships. That's really what he kind of, where he comes from. So his parents, Anne Marie and Andrew Jackson, were living in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And as this is the 1850s and strictures against free colored people, mixing with whites and slaves, they're tightening. The rules around them are tightening. They used to be able to vote. They could no longer vote. As things were heating up during that led ultimately to the Civil War. They decide to leave. They go to Cleveland. They don't go together. They didn't know each other. They met en route. At least that's how Helen tells the story. They meet. They get married. They have Chestnut, who's their firstborn. They have two more sons in Cleveland. And Chestnut's father, the story goes, serves in the Civil War for the Union side. He works as a teamster. And at the end of the Civil War, he decides to return to Fayetteville. He brings his family with him. And he lives, Chestnut is around 10 years old at the time when he returns, 10, 9 years old. And he returns to Fayetteville. He knows his grandfather, Andrew Jackson, who's a pretty old man at this point, but he leaves land to the Chestnut family, to his father and mother and their children. And works there, goes to school there at the Howard School, which his father, Andrew Jackson, helps to found. And his mother, unfortunately, dies giving birth to her last child, a girl. And that's when Chestnut has to drop out of school. And he eventually gets a job as a teacher. His mentor, who was also his teacher, is Robert L. Harris, who's the principal of the Howard School. Chestnut eventually works his way up to become an assistant principal to Robert Harris. And then upon his death, serves as principal of the Howard School. And he is principal of the Howard School. He gets married to Susan Perry when he's around 20 years old. They have four children together. And he moves to the North, first New York City, and then Cleveland, where he settles and lives for the rest of his life.
You know, you begin your book with him getting published in the Atlantic magazine, which is very important. Talk about the importance of the short story as a genre, and also the fact that, you know, at that time, people were reading short stories in like magazines and newspapers.
That's a really important feature of this time, which we now know as the Gilded Age, named after Twain's co-written novel. The proliferation of magazines and newspapers in this period is a really important feature of Chestnut's life. So I spent quite a bit of time writing about that in the biography, because it's kind of different from now. Really, the only magazines to publish short fiction that you read regularly is The New Yorker, right? You don't find short stories in The Spectator or in even in The Atlantic anymore. I'm not seeing any short stories as the current Atlantic.
Right.
But then there were so many magazines that had short fiction that people would read during their lunch break, that they would read before bed. And that was the main way that people were introduced to new authors. Mm-hmm. So Chestnut is known to be the first Black writer to publish fiction in the Atlantic Monthly. Mm-hmm. And the story that he publishes in 1887 that's accepted for publication is a story called The Guford Grapevine, which becomes one of the Conjure Woman tales that he collects and publishes, a book of these short stories that has Uncle Julius as the narrator. And he has this framing device of these two white characters, a married couple named John and Annie, who move from Ohio to North Carolina and buy some property, a vineyard, and they meet Uncle Julius, who is by that time, this is in the post-slavery period, post-emancipation, he's living on that land, and they hire him as their coachman. So these are conversations between John and Annie and Uncle Julius, but the story is unfolding, and they're compelling stories of what Uncle Julius remembers of the time, as he puts it, before the war.
Let's look at the other side of the table.
Yeah.
The editors, okay? Why would an editor want to publish a Chestnut story, and what are they trying to say to their audience? They must be trying to say, okay, they're presenting something by this Black author to a readership. So it must be saying, they must take into consideration, what does the readership want to hear or what want to read about?
That's a great question, a hard one to answer, because when Chestnut first publishes this short story, he's already published little short vignettes with S.S. McClure, that he's very short pieces in magazines like Puck. They're humorous sketches, really. So he's gotten this kind of practice of writing for a primarily mainstream white audience. And, you know, this is the time of Joel Chandler Harris, who's really popular with his short stories. This is the post-slavery period. The preference is for humorous stories that bring whites and blacks north and south together. There's the tensions of the Civil War need to be put in the past. And I think Chestnut's stories were attractive to editors at the time because that's what they were kind of doing. They were bringing John and Annie, this northern white couple, very literate, together with Uncle Julius, a former illiterate slave, together. And they were having a conversation. This was actually pretty novel for the time.
Let me ask you, as a biographer of Chestnut, are you, and you were looking at the material, did you come across conversation between like the writer and the editor, and where someone says, okay, I want you to change this particular story or the ending or whatever, or to flesh out the character?
Yeah, you know, you see a lot of that in the antebellum period, like Lydia Maria Child does this with Harriet Jacobs, famously, right? And you see that kind of thing. Chestnut would write stories, and he was asking for feedback from his white editors, for people like Walter Hines Page, who I talk about, Albion Turgay. He's not an editor, but he's another novelist, the lead defense attorney on the Plessy versus Ferguson case, George Washington Cable. So this is really, I would call it kind of more collaborative. They're as we do now, you know, you send a friend a draft of the story and they give you some feedback and you take what you can use and you leave out what you don't want. I saw a lot of that kind of back and forth, but there wasn't as they were asking for changes, especially with the story, with the what became his first published novel, The House Behind the Cedars, which he spends a long time revising and revising in order to get somebody to want to publish it. He was getting negative feedback. People would just say, oh, well, I don't like this story. So he would just revise it and send it out again.
Okay. One last question before we take a break. Sure. and bring Katia back in and remind people to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 and make their pledge. The question I want to ask you, Charles Chestnut had skills. Talk about his skill as a stenographer and how that influenced his writing and his career.
Yeah, that was one of the most difficult parts of doing the biography, was learning shorthand Pittman.
I figured you had to do that, right?
You know, like I had to get textbooks out. I had a colleague whose mother was a secretary in the 1960s and 70s, so she helped me decipher some of this to know what it was. And that is to be able to write in symbols so that you could write as fast as people were talking. And this was, you know, this is before the recorder, before audio recording.
So you mean you got skills now too, right?
I got a few skills. I mean, nothing near what Chestnut had, but I can decipher some of these symbols. And so this allowed Chestnut, first of all, to be hired in a kind of literary way. And this allowed Chestnut to also record preachers, record men and women who couldn't read and write, and he would record them. And this form of vernacular was really important for the kind of fiction that he was writing.
Mm. You know, it's interesting because, you know, it seems as if there were future biographers coming up, they would probably have to master the skill that you have because it was so important. But talk about how, you know, he has to make this decision between, you know, being a writer and being, you know, and just having a job.
Yeah. He really believed that he could make money at writing. Mm-hmm. And this is another one of the reasons that I think Chestnut sometimes gets overlooked, as you were saying before, in course syllabi. He doesn't have a purely kind of romantic notion of wanting to uplift the race by writing. Really, he also wants to make a living by it. And if he can't make a living by it, he's going to do something else by which he can make a living. So in his journals, he debated becoming a doctor. He became a lawyer. He became a court reporter. And this was all to supplement his income. He did eventually, after the publication of his first two collections of short stories, he quit his day job as a court reporter in order to focus full time on his writing. But he couldn't sustain himself and his four children and his wife on that salary.
See, I'm glad you said that, because we can't sustain this station unless we make have people support us. And so we're going to take a little break. My guest is Tess Chicalica. We were talking about her fascinating biography of Charles Chestnut, A Man of Complexion. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM. And we're going to take a little break and listen to the social justice calendar, and also bring Katia back in to help with the pitching.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, August 4th, 2025.
Thursday, August 7th, the African American Music Association is saluting Baba Saleem Hilton from 5 to 9 p.m. for 50 years of community service in entertainment, youth development, and restorative justice. The celebration takes place in Mitchellville, Maryland, at the Country Club at Woodmore, 12320 Pleasant Park. For more details, visit the website aamadc.org. Or call 202-552-0000. On Thursday, August 7th at 6 p.m., there will be a potluck and presentation from Dave Oak, Sacred Land of Apache. It will be located at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street Northwest, Tacoma, D.C. For more info, please visit www.seekerschurch.org. Friday, August 8th, Strengths of the Black Family, Lifting and Affirming the Strength of Black Families with Elder Michael D. Campbell and Eldress Jackie Campbell will take place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit Sankofa.com. Sunday, August 10th, Gaza on Our Mind, a bi-weekly community gathering, will take place from 7 to 9 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info and to RSVP, visit Sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, is Katia there?
I'm right here, Ethelbert.
Okay, and, you want to say something?
I'd love to. I'd love to, first of all, thank Anonymous out of Greenbelt, Maryland. And they say this pledge is in memory of their Uncle Larry Boddy, who was your Howard classmate.
Oh, yeah, Larry, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a wonderful thing. Yes, indeed. And we still have $460 to go. We have 28 minutes to do it, folks. You've always come through for the excellent work that Ethelbert does and the caliber of guests that he has. And again, today is no different. It is a fascinating listen, really. I'm going to have to read the book, I think, because I'm really enthralled by this man's work and how he was forgotten and then revived. His work was forgotten and then revived. So if you're like me and you're out there listening, and I know many people are, then please go to the phone and pledge your support right now. That number, 800-222-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org, $460 to go. And I want to remind folks that sustaining membership is a great way to make a larger donation, if you like, and have it broken down into increments. So today, if you pledge $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 a month, $100 a month, whatever is in your wallet and budget, Ethelbert would get the credit for the entire amount, and you will be able to make payments over a certain amount of time, which really helps Ethelbert and WPFW, but also helps you. So however you get to us, be in solidarity with us right now. Literary works are so important. And in this Google, because that's what I just did, right, because that's what I had available, in this Google world, we see that often literature, you know, books, vinyl, all the things that we used to hold in our hands are rapidly declining. And to find a bookstore, a local bookstore, to find a local record store is increasingly difficult. So to have this literary program is really a gem. And Ethelbert is so wonderful. So we ask you to pledge your support. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org, $460 to go. Ethelbert?
Okay, thank you. Tess Jakalica, talk about, we were talking about sonography. Talk about how it helps him capture Black speech and his, and talk about the relationship in terms of his importance in terms of Black speech and capturing African-American folklore.
Yeah, I mean, this is, as you know, of course, a very important aspect of African-American literature and culture. And you see that in so many writers of the period. And after, and well after, for instance, in the writings of Zora Neale Hurston, who's writing a generation after Chestnut is writing. But Chestnut's ear for this, he's not doing interviews in the way that Zora Neale Hurston was in her anthropological...
And measuring heads.
Yeah, exactly. He's not doing that. He's simply listening. And he's listening to, as I said previously, to preachers, to his neighbors, to the stories that they tell. And in fact, the whole conjure, if you want to call it a tradition or a custom, that he documents in his stories is it first sort of started by listening to when he was living at his wife's parents' house after they got married. He says that they had a gardener working there. Hmm. He would talk to the gardener and listen to his stories, and he would tell him stories about his time in slavery. And so though Chestnut himself and his parents and grandparents were never enslaved, he's teaching former slaves. He's talking to former slaves, and he's also talking to former Confederate soldiers, white Southerners. He's listening and talking to everybody. As Katia mentioned, you know, bookstores were really important. Independent bookstores were really important to Chestnut's development. There was one in the Market House that was owned by a former Confederate soldier that he frequented often, and it was there that they would have conversations. And then after their conversation, he would go home to his journal and record the conversation. And as he did this, they would slowly develop, or he would use parts of what he recorded in his journal, and he would form them into little short stories and later longer novels.
Mm. Charles Chestnut comes before the Harlem Renaissance or New Negro Movement. Describe his relationship with three people, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and Frederick Douglass.
So I'll start with Frederick Douglass first, since he's the oldest, you might say, of them, and maybe even still the best known, especially in the D.C. area where his house still is.
Cedar Hill, right, yeah, southeast.
Right, and open to the public. He was the first biographer of Frederick Douglass. He published a biography, a little biography of Douglass's life in 1899. That came out with the Beacon Press. Small Maynard and Company was a series of great Americans. And he was really asked, given his repertoire, to write that biography. And then he was asked to write a kind of follow-up to that a few years later by Walter Hines Page, but he decided not to. Douglass was a hugely important figure for Chestnut, a kind of exemplar or model for his own life, someone who really, really pulled himself up from his bootstraps, you might say, and made his way to freedom, despite all the odds against him. And like Chestnut, he relied on reading, on learning to read, and books in order to secure that freedom. So Chestnut also not only was the first biographer of Frederick Douglass, he was the only biographer who met and heard Douglass give a speech in the post-Civil War period, which I discuss in the book, because he was hired by the Republican Party of Charlotte, North Carolina, to be the speech recorder for that event. And it was published in the newspaper, which I miraculously found, and quote at length in the biography. So Chesnut's biography of Frederick Douglass is definitely worth reading. It's a very different kind of biography than, you know, David Blight's Pulitzer Prize winning biography or others before that. And in part, he really focuses on Douglass's post-slavery life. Who Douglass became as a politician, as a businessman, as an entrepreneur. And it's very short, and it was meant to be carried around in people's pockets so that they could refer to it, you know, as they were doing their other things, something very accessible.
It's the whole thing of the pocketbook.
Yes, it was it should fit in your pocket. Walt Whitman had a similar idea about Song of Myself. Remember, you're supposed to be able to keep it close to your chest.
Right.
He had a similar thing with Frederick Douglass's biography. He kept Douglass very close to him. He had a portrait of Douglass in his study for most of his time as a writer. So Douglass was an important figure. Du Bois and Washington, he knew personally. He worked very closely with Booker T. Washington. He was friends with Booker T. Washington. He visited Tuskegee on several occasions with his wife. He knew Washington's wife. They were family friends. And they had many disagreements over the years. They wrote about each other, but they liked each other. And these were men who disagreed and maintained a friendship until Washington's death. And then Du Bois, he was not as close to, but he certainly admired Du Bois. They had a long correspondence back and forth. I think Du Bois was a little bit skeptical of Chesnut's place. He did say at one point that Chesnut was the greatest of the Black writers that he had read, and he celebrated Chesnut's work. But at the same time, I think he was a little bit irritated with Chesnut for not being more political. You know, because, of course, Du Bois has that criteria for Negro art. All art is propaganda. Chesnut was totally against that. He really believed that that kind of political division and bias was the death of art, as he put it. So he had disagreements with both men, and his commitment was always to literature first, to telling a good story. From all sides. Remember, as a court reporter, he had to be able to listen to both sides of every argument. And that really separated him from the big political leaders of the time, like Washington and Du Bois.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into something I think is interesting. I met you at Williams College. Okay.
You actually met me even before then.
Okay. But I associated with Williams. And, you know, Sterling Brown. You know, we're having a conference coming up on Sterling Brown in September. Sterling Brown is also a Williams person.
Yeah.
When I look at Sterling's anthology, the Negro Caravan that he did with Arthur B. Davis and Ulysses Lee, I'm looking at his entry in terms of Chesnut, and also he has a section there on folk literature. And it seems as if Sterling Brown is really understanding Chesnut's work. And when you said listening, I'm thinking about how Brown is not a stenographer, but Brown is going down south and listening to people. Okay. So is there a good connection between that you could make between, did you look at Brown's work on Chesnut? And
I did. Okay. Yeah. I mean, Brown, like Brawley, like Griffith, these are Black critics, let's call them, for lack of a better term, who were early appreciators of Chesnut's work.
Could you throw in James Weldon Johnson too?
Absolutely. James Weldon Johnson's in there, too. That really appreciated what Chesnut was doing, his craft. And Sterling Brown, I think, used Chesnut's work as a model for how to do literature that includes Black characters and white characters living and talking side by side. And then, as you know, when the Black Power movement, the Harlem Renaissance, performs a kind of commitment to the celebration of Black culture and art that is separate, and in some cases better than the corollary white American literature or whatever culture, that's a different kind of art that's being used for political purposes. for the creation of a culture, for and for good reason. I'm not actually denouncing that or anything. It's just a different kind of literature and art that's being produced from this sort of conversational art form that people like Sterling Brown and Chestnut are interested in, telling stories from multiple perspectives. I mean, isn't that what literature is? Right. And you see that is a defining feature of Chestnut's art, that you don't get the didacticism of the propaganda or art, not for art's sake, but art for a specific political purpose.
Okay, and now, as we get towards the end of our show, the big question, You know, how does Chestnut navigate race, color, and class? We talk a lot about race, but especially in terms of color and also class, because when I think of, you know, some of Chestnut, I'm thinking of like the tragic mulatto theme that pops up in African-American literature. So talk about how he navigates these themes.
Yeah, and you know, the whole tragic mulatto theme is from an earlier period. Somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like you see that Niall Leroy a little bit, though Iola doesn't die at the end. You see it in some of Francis Harper's later work. And I guess it's in the house behind the Cedars, because not to give it away, but our very light-skinned black heroine dies.
It's sort of like Nella Larson stuff, too, with passing.
Exactly. And he's kind of close to Nella Larson in this, and in his bird's eye view of the black community at the time and the colorism and hierarchy that exists along shades of color that exist, particularly in the North, when he shifts his focus to Cleveland, to his now new hometown. And so that collection of short stories that appears alongside The Conjure Woman, The Wife of His Youth, and other stories of the color line, mostly set in Ohio, you see that colorism at work and the damage that it does, particularly when it comes to the marriage plot. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, the title of the biography, A Matter of Complexion, is a somewhat veiled, but not really, allusion to his one of my favorite of his short stories called A Matter of Principle, which is one of his blue vein stories, in which the father is trying to arrange his daughter's marriage to a light-skinned black man. But there's one of those mistaken identity. And it's comedy. It's comedy on the level of Jane Austen, really, where this arranged marriage is kind of going awry, and we learn a lesson at the end of it, or at least the main character is supposed to have learned a lesson, but not really. So Chestnut at once is laughing at these color distinctions in order to perhaps diminish them or to show the folly of them to his reader. And at the same time, he's living and perhaps even benefiting from that hierarchy, given the fact that he is a very light-skinned black man himself. And so this is a question I often get when I, you know, talk about Chestnut. Was his light skin one of the reasons why he was able to be so successful?
You know, I mean, that's another issue. You could also connect with Sterling Brown in terms of complexion. And I think that's something that we see. And I want to bring that into your selection of photographs, because you have one on the cover. I want to talk about that one. But then what I found, which was not in your book, was the one that the New York Times ran when they published a review of your book back in March 16th of this year. But that was him like in his study.
Yeah.
You know, but I said, well, this is a great picture.
I agree.
You know, in fact, that's why I stopped at, I was reading, Tess wrote this book. Okay. But I got stopped by the photograph. I wondered, were there any restrictions in terms of photographs, in terms of decision? Did you make the decision for the cover photograph?
Honestly, I did not. It was really the publisher. I think they wanted a kind of close up shot of Chestnut. Here's a writer that most people don't know. The one of him in his study is actually a little bit of a lower quality, I think, and they wanted something with high resolution that would really grab people when they looked at the book. It's really about, you know, enticing a reader to buy the book. That's how I see it. I, mm-hmm. like you, there were few photos of him in his study, which I really love. But I think he kind of like is a smaller figure and you don't get such a close up of him because you see the whole study around him. So they really wanted to focus on Chestnut, the person. I think that's why you've got that close up shot.
Yeah, I think about photography, and I also immediately think of Frederick Douglass because he was so photographed. But I was also wondering, in terms of as a biographer, when you're looking at these collections, are there photographs that you may want to use, but they're not labeled, you know, they're not identified, or what happens? Somebody is standing in a crowd of people, and you say, okay, I know who two of these people are, but who are the rest?
Yeah, you definitely get that. So I have photographs from the Library of Congress that I used to about the. That was taken at the Armenia conference that he attended. The other thing to keep in mind, there are actually a lot of photographs of Charles Chestnut and his family because his brothers, Arthur and Lewis, were the first professional Black photographers in Cleveland. Hmm. They had their own studio. It was called Chestnut Brothers. So at both Fisk and Case, at the Cleveland Public Library and at the Western Reserve Historical Society, you'll find a lot of photographs of Chestnut and family members that were taken throughout their lives. So they're scattered all over the place. I could only include so many that would kind of go with my story in order to help the reader visualize some of the characters that I discuss. But if people want to go, I mean, all of this has, most of these collections are public access. Fisk's collection is now restricted, partly.
Why is it restricted?
Partly because the material now is very fragile. And I think they're working, trying to digitize some of that. And they need to preserve, especially the journals, I think, are really kind of crumbling because of use, because they've been used so much over the years and for other reasons that, you know, only librarians would know.
Okay. Let me ask you a question of how biographers work. I recall, for example, Robert Henry doing the biography of Zora Neale Hurston, but then also saying down in Florida that, oh, he hoped that a Black woman would do the biography of Zora Neale Hurston. Valerie Boyd was there, you know, and she heard that. And he was very helpful to her. Looking at what you've done in terms of coming after Helen and your biography, what type of things should future biographers of Chestnut, or do you see yourself, well, this is the Ethelbert, this is the definitive biography?
No, I agree with you. I think there should be future biographers. I've really focused on the literary culture of the period, thinking about his relationship with other writers of the time and his editors. You know, recently I've become acquainted with members of the Idlewild, Michigan summer resort.
No, yeah, that's like Martha Vineyard for people who can't get to East.
Exactly. And I went out there and I gave a talk, and a lovely woman has begun. Her name is Colleen Atkins. She's begun the Charles Chestnut Literary Society of Idlewild. She bought his cottage and has preserved much of his furniture and the way it looked. And Chestnut, after he published his last published novel in 1905, he continued to write and work, and he knew many writers. And that kind of that post, or that almost like that post-publishing life that he had, his law career that I don't write a lot about, his court reporting career. He had his own court reporting business. He had a woman partner named Helen Moore. There are lots of letters between the two of them that I don't really discuss. People could do more work.
And I guess there's also that need where somebody, I guess somebody would also just say, okay, I'm going to do a literary biography. I'm going to really look at the text.
Yeah.
You know, just look at the novel, look at the short story, right, from a literary point.
I mean, William Andrews did in 1980 publish a kind of biography called The Literary Career of Charles Chestnut. And this was before many of his books had been republished in 1980. So it was kind of early. So this is sort of like an updating of William Andrews, trying to bring together Helen's biography with William Andrews. And I've done this, and I'm sure someone after me will bring the three of us together and then take it a step further. So I love the idea of more work being done on Charles Chestnut, not less.
And I hope that there's more work being done. I hope there's more money being given to WPFW because we're listening to you, and it's fascinating discussing Tess Chicago in terms of talking about Charles Chestnut. Katia, do you want to close us out in a prayer or something?
Prayer.
there. We're getting to that. Okay. Well, no, but what I would like to do is thank Diane out of Tacoma Park. Thank you so much, Diane. And she says she loves Ethelbert's show. She loves Ethelbert's show. And we still have $410 to go. So quickly, just to give the number again, let's make this goal, folks. We can do it. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. You can also go to your phone. If you're on your phone, text WPFWFM to 801-801. Or if you use Cash App, you can send to WPFWFM. Make sure you put on the margin in the note so we know that it is for Ethelbert. It's been a beautiful show, Ethelbert. Thank you. Again, listeners, $410 to go. This show is definitely worth it, as are all of his shows. So please make that call that makes a difference. Thank you, Ethelbert.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have time for one last thing, Mike? Or that's it? Okay, is it? Oh, I'm so sad. Tess, thank you very much for being my guest here on the margin this morning. So that's it. My name is Ethelbert Miller, the station story PFW 89.3 FM.
If you're a WPFW supporter, please take a moment and record a testimonial as to why you support Jazz and Justice Radio on our testimonials hotline at 202-588-0796. Messages must be 1 minute or less. It is with your generosity that we are able to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. And we thank you.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo and Rwanda recently signed a peace agreement in Washington under the aegis of the Trump administration. It is supposed to lay the foundation for a minerals deal that would usher in greater U.S. investment in Congo's mineral sector, with Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and others in the billionaire class taking the lead. WPFW, Africa Roll Now Project, Friends of the Congo, and Action for Congo will host a discussion and film screening on Sunday, August 17th, 5 to 7 p.m., at the 14th and V location of Bus Boys and Poets. The event entitled Peace or Profit, Donald Trump's Minerals Deal in the Congo, will unpack the peace agreement and outline the implications for Africa. Details at Eventbrite on the Friends of the Congo. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Stephanie Wells, Executive Director of Pacifica Foundation. Congress has defunded public media, threatening the survival of television and radio stations that provide trusted news, emergency alerts, and vital community connection. Years of corporate media consolidation and deregulation have taken media out of community hands, while social media platforms cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
Calling all lovers of house music. House on the Waterfront Weekender's finale happens Sunday, August 10th at Bladensburg Waterfront Park in Bladensburg, Maryland. This event runs from 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. and promises a day filled with music, entertainment, vendors, and more. With DJ sets by Tommy Wiggins, DJ A.Plain, Byron B. Note Brown, Derek D. Train Coleman, and DJ Rita J. Kelly Burns. Park grounds open at 8:30 a.m. Details available at HOTWMD on Facebook and Instagram.
The African American Music Association will honor Dr. Saleem Hilton for his community service and career in restorative justice Youth Development and Entertainment on Thursday, August 7th, 5 to 9 p.m. at the Country Club at Woodmore, 12320 Pleasant Prospect, Mitchellville, Maryland. Details available by calling Beverly Lindsay Johnson at 202-552-0000.
Jazzy Sundays at Anacostia, an 8-week jazz and R&B concert series happening this Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m. in the heart of the Anacostia Arts District at 1234 Marion Barry Avenue. Food vendors will be on site and lawn chairs are welcome. Jazzy Sundays in Anacostia runs through Sunday, September the 7th. Details at anacostiabid.org.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in to hear a refreshing angle on today's state of affairs and other issues other media intentionally overlook. Find the episodes on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. Only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
The Birchmere presents Switch, August 10th, and Jazz Funk Soul featuring Jeff Lorber, Everett Hart.